everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, we are continuing with our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series. The topic, our culture and society in collapse, and signs of a new way forward or a breakdown. Either way you look at it, we are either optimistic and see this as a breakthrough, or we see it as a scarcity of ideas and a breakdown. If it's a breakdown, there's going to be chaos. There will be a world changed, especially in the United States, where income inequality, where the separation of those with power and versus those with no power, with those who've paid allegiance to those in power and therefore are given special privileges, and those who've challenged or been indifferent or not supported the existing power system, who are then condemned, ridiculed, mocked, and most importantly, shamed. Our current culture is one based upon those shaming anyone if you make the wrong word in a sentence, if you make the wrong gesture. Even if you're completely accurate in what you say, someone could be offended, feel their life is threatened, feel that they can no longer live because you made a statement, or you're even going to give a lecture that they know nothing about, but because you support a particular maybe humanistic point of view or spiritual point of view, their whole existence feels threatened, and therefore they should have the right, because they are so sensitive, to come and scream and throw bricks and beat you to a pulp because you've made them feel threatened. That's actually existing, has been for some time. And on one hand, what are we going to do about it? How will we even view this? Is this something positive? Should we look forward to the mass chaos that is ensuing now in different parts of America? Should we engage it? And if so, in what way? Or should we just simply be, as we have historically, indifferent? The silent majority. And the silent majority may find that this time their silence on global warming or any environmental issue is to their detriment, because now it's beyond anyone's control. Or maybe their silence on the 16 million hungry children who don't have enough food, but it's not their children, therefore it's not important. Or maybe it's on what has happened to the corruption in our government and governmental agencies, and those who have been selected to run agencies all have corporatized neoliberal philosophies, right or left, doesn't matter. Doesn't matter who's in office, the people who really had the power behind the scenes. And should we stay indifferent? These are issues I think about, and I've invited Jim Garrison on to discuss them. Dr. Jim Garrison is the founding president of Ubiquity University and the Wisdom School of Graduate Studies, which is an international school of higher education built upon transformational principles of whole brain, whole systems learning. The university operates with partners all over the world. As the co-founder and president of the Gorbachev Foundation, Jim was instrumental in the founding of the State of the World Forum to lay a template for a more sustainable global civilization. In the late 80s, he served as the executive director of the Esalen Institute, Soviet-American Exchange, and founded the International Foreign Policy Association collaboration with Secretary of State George Shultz and also the Georgian President Edward Shevardnadze. He is the author of America as Empire, Global Leader or Rogue Power, and hosts the daily podcast Humanity Rising Summit, conversations with people with the cutting edge of cultural change. Jim has graduate degrees in religion theology from Harvard University, Cambridge University. His website is ubiquityuniversity.org and wisdomuniversity.org. Nice to have you with us today, Jim.
Thank you, Gary. It's always a pleasure.
Jim, I'd like to first address the new world we are entering, for better or worse. During the past 7 months following the announcement, global warnings of the coronavirus pandemic, what we are witnessing is nothing less than a structural and social breakdown. Intended or not, the outbreak and spread of the virus is perhaps best understood by what Nassim Taleb describes as the Black Swan event. Or for people in the audience who may not know that, it's an event that takes an institution or even nation completely by surprise, like a tornado, and whose consequences cannot be predicted beforehand. Hence, we're left helpless. We have to scramble at the last moment. And that is one way of viewing the impact of the pandemic and how it has turned the functioning and governance of our societies completely upside down. However, I feel it might be even more accurate and prescient to view these current crises that we are witnessing all around us not as a black swan event, but what New York University economist Nouriel Roubini described back in 2010 as a white swan. Roubini argues that believing these events and their consequences are unpredictable is nothing more than an assumption or wishful thinking. In fact, these crises and breakdowns, such as the Great Recession of 2008, were completely predictable. Unfortunately, our leaders in government, private industry, and the banks and financial sectors, corporate stooges in our media, refused to pay attention to the indicators that serious catastrophic signs were on the horizon. Instead, they just continued with business as usual. So what the coronavirus is teaching us is that we have been ignoring the most important things about life: equality, civil and human rights, racism and the future of war, violence and conflict, health care, the poor and the homeless, our entire judicial system for far too long. These are issues that have festered like a non-healing abscess, and we simply covered it up, both Democrats and Republicans. For many decades, this has gone on, at least the last 50 years. And now, all of our failures and lost opportunities in the past are showing their heads. So one could say that this crisis, not just the pandemic, but everything else our dominant culture has been in denial of, is being set on fire. And if we wish, we can consciously look upon this as a kind of awakening, perhaps a new opportunity. But I'm not a Pollyanna, nor am I of a clarion perception. Instead, and this then we'll turn it over to you for as long as you take to answer it, which is fine, I see something more contrived and unfortunately more sinister. I have seen people do and say anything to maintain power, both on the left and the right. But right now, both are equally engaged in maintaining power without any thought of what it will do to the average citizen. On my recent program, I listed 20 different issues that neither party has dealt with in the last 50 years. Neither. With all the money spent, all the opportunity, nothing done, even when one or the other had complete control of Congress. I'll give you a few examples. The last statistic of a year ago showed 16 million hungry children, food insecure. Some families, believe it or not, in the United States, individuals, are under $2 a day in income. You're dealing with now over 20 million hungry children. Nothing being done. A continuation of the war and genocide in Yemen that we have supported and enabled Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. Nothing done. The assault against Libya and the innocence of its people as the number one country out of the 54 countries in Africa. Nothing done to either apologize or to help the people of Libya. In fact, nothing is being done about global warming in the United States at all. Nothing is being done to look beyond the corporatist, green capitalist model that Al Gore and others promote. We're not looking at geothermal. We're not looking at wave power. Nothing. Greta Thunberg came to the United States. Her message was important and was accurate. But behind her was a master manipulation, probably the best that I've ever seen in my lifetime, where she was coached, and the people behind her were looking at how they could control a multi-trillion dollar industry, the global warming industry, but none had solutions. And to this day, nothing has changed. As millions of students went on strike on Fridays, well, we haven't become a vegan nation, not even 1% more veganism, or things actually stop it. The average American has done nothing to change their quality of life or standard of living, which would contribute to lessening global warming or the overconsumption. In fact, we, along with China and India, have actually increased our carbon dioxide levels. So again, nothing. We have done nothing to get the nonviolent prisoners not to go to jail in the first place and let them out of jail if they're in there and given pardons. Nothing. We've increased private prisons, increased debtors' prisons, increases punitive fines, increasing the industries like the payday loan industry and credit cards to give compounding interest on people. We've done nothing to forgive student loans. We have done nothing to be honest about artificial intelligence, transhumanism, the visa program for students coming in, and the automation, all of which are eviscerating jobs, especially those who are more educated with seniority. Nothing at all to protect them. Nothing to bring industry back into ghettoized areas to rejuvenate those areas. So those are some of the topics we've done nothing about. So on the one hand, where I am an optimist as an individual, I can no longer say I'm an optimist because I see the fingerprints of special interest groups using important and legitimate causes of concern and demonstrating and voicing our concern, but they're being manipulated. As a result, no matter who wins, and I believe at this time the overwhelming propensity would be for the Democrats to win, I see things only getting worse, not better, because at the end of the day, people cannot dine on platitudes. They cannot bathe in the certainty of cleansing the spirit with nice, cheesy words. I see nothing concrete being offered that would fundamentally change us to a breakthrough society, learning our lessons, transforming our awareness, where we're not any longer a shame society and then a destroy the person we're shaming society. There is no forgiveness in the current mindset in America. Those are my thoughts. Please challenge them as you will and lay out your thoughts. Sorry for the long introduction, but I wanted to get it all out so you have a lot to work with.
That's what I enjoy about our dialogues, Gary. You have very specific points of view that are backed up by evidence, and they're comprehensively thought through. And I think you're pointing to a number of things that are coming together in some ways like a perfect storm. First, let me say that I agree with the position that the pandemic is a white swan event. It's a black swan event only if you're not paying attention. The fact is that scientists the world over have been predicting not only the escalation and accelerating frequency of extreme weather events, but the rise of infectious diseases and pandemics. It's worth just noting that John Lovelock, who's responsible for the Gaia hypothesis, now the Gaia theory, wrote the very famous book called Gaia, in which he asserted for the first time scientifically that the Earth is an organism that is demonstrating intelligence in the shaping of the evolution of life on Earth. His view was that by the year 2100, upwards of 90 to 95% of the human race is going to be wiped out. And the reason is a combination of three factors. One is natural calamities, and we've seen that all around the world, typhoons, hurricanes, all kinds of floodings, droughts, desertification that are destroying cities, habitats. You can include in that the rising of sea levels. Secondly, is the spread of war as people migrate. We're already seeing that. There are more water refugees than war refugees right now. If the headwaters of the Himalayan plateau dry up as expected, the glaciers, which are in radical melt, that means most of Asia will be without sufficient water. And that includes not only India, but with the the Indus in the Ganges, but the Mekong in Vietnam, and the great rivers of China. So just imagine if hundreds of millions of people start to migrate. Where will they go? What will happen to them? And then thirdly is the rise of infectious diseases. One of the things that's happening as ecology begins to be disrupted in such a devastating way is that the basic ecosystem of viruses and bacteria and various life forms that up until, you know, several decades ago were in relative equilibrium are all being broken out. Example of this is in Siberia, where probably the most danger rests actually with the release of methane as the permafrost of Siberia, that vast, vast landmass of Upper Russia melts. What's coming out of the earth is methane. But in addition to that, there are bacteria and viruses that are popping up that have been frozen for millions of years, and against which the human species has no immune response. So when you take these rising consequences of our failure of dealing just with climate change, to say nothing about the other 15 or 20 urgent global issues, ranging from the acceleration of species extinction all around the world, water scarcity, deforestation, the plastic infusion into our oceans, the loss of our fish stocks, the pollution of every conceivable square millimeter of planet Earth. You get extreme weather events. You get migrations of people in war, and you get the rise of infectious diseases. And all three of those are in motion. And so the point that I would make about the pandemic is that it's not a unique event. It is, first of all, a predicted event. And if you look back over the last, you know, 10, 15, 20, 30 years, you've had these different outbreaks. Remember Ebola, remember SARS, remember Hong Kong flu, remember, what was it, the avian flu. There's been all kinds of small contained pandemics, and each time the scientists are saying it's not gonna stop. This is gonna get worse. We've gotta do something about these basic issues. And as you're pointing out, because nothing is being done, not only in the United States, but largely at a planetary level, largely because the United States blocks it, particularly on climate change. This is not only predictable, but it's going to get worse. This was a pandemic that maybe takes out 1% of the population. I don't know what the statistics are, but as you all know, the rise of events of infections is increasing around the world. It's now gone beyond 11 million, upwards of 300,000 deaths. The statistics in the United States are off the chart and do not indicate any trajectory of stabilization. And within that context, I think it's worth touching on another issue that you raise. You know, there's been all kinds of studies that have linked incontrovertibly the disparity in wealth in a nation with murder rates, suicide rates, mental illness rates, prison rates, disease rates. The greater the disparity of wealth in a country, the more the country breaks down. And that's just a statistical fact. And so if you're in a country like the United States, and in fact, in a world economy of characterized by neoliberal capitalist economics, where the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer en masse, and now you have literally a handful of a couple dozen billionaires that control, you know, 60, 70, 80% of the planetary wealth, with masses of human beings at the bottom end of that scale, you've got the recipe for absolute disaster. And that's what is now beginning to take shape. And then I think, you know, the other piece, which I think is for all Americans, is staring us right in the face, is the fact that the United States of America, that we believed for 2.5 centuries was God's gift to humanity, the light on top of the hill, the beacon of democracy to the world, is none of those things. And in fact, the United States is succumbing to quite literally a failed state. Infrastructure's breaking down, the divisiveness of our politics, our healthcare system is breaking down, our welfare service system has been broken for a very long time. Our educational system is in a state of collapse. There are very few things that the United States is doing right now other than in Silicon Valley and the accelerating technology of, you know, artificial intelligence, robotics, automation, and technological change of all kind, where the United States is the lead. It used to be number one or in the top two or three, but in healthcare, it's down in the 20s and 30s. It's got one of the highest prison rates in the entire world. And so what I think Americans need to come to grips with is not only is that the pandemic is a sign of things to come, but simultaneously, this great nation of ours is falling into disrepair and is, I would say, in an advanced state of collapse. And that is one of the reasons why the Democrats, like the Republicans, are ineffectual, amoral, incompetent, and completely impotent to generate even the ideas. And the fact that the Democratic Party in the year 2020, when we're facing challenges that boggle the mind, would nominate someone like Joe Biden as our nominee, it's a travesty, not at the level of Trump, but it is such a systemic failure to understand not only the gravity of the crisis that we are in as a country and as a world, and a world that desperately wants U.S. leadership, but it is a complete failure of imagination in terms of coming up with any of the solutions that are so desperately needed. And then the final thing that I would say, which is to state, you know, the obvious again from scientists all over the world, this state of affairs is not going to go on indefinitely. We're being told clearly that we've got about 10 years, that this decade of the 2020s is perhaps the most important decade in the history of the human race. We're either going to solve some of these critical problems, at the center of which is runaway climate change, or scientists are beginning to speculate on the possible extinction of the human species itself. And that may be hyperbole at one level, because I'm sure there will be some survivors. but the starkness of our situation that is confronting us is that we have escalating crises and a diminishing time frame within which to solve them. So what we're trying to do with Humanity Rising and Ubiquity University is to track the opportunity vector that's inherent in the crisis. And let me give you just a couple quick examples of some extraordinary things that are beginning to happen. Because as you know, the Chinese definition of crisis, it's dangerous opportunity. So one of the things we did, for example, when the pandemic hit, and you know, I don't think any of us really were prepared for the severity and the universality of the pandemic, nor that within weeks we would all be locked down, engaging in social distancing, and our economies essentially turned off. And I think the draconian responses of our governments, having not done anything to prevent the crisis, was inversely proportional to the solutions that we should have embraced. But that's a whole other matter. I just raised this here just to say that we thought, well, listen, if this is also an opportunity, what should we do? And what Ubiquity University did, we convened Humanity Rising. And within literally weeks, we had over 300, now going on 400 partnering organizations and hundreds of people from all over the world. And we did something very simple. We just opened up the Zoom line between 5 and 7 o'clock p.m. Central European time. Every day for the purpose of letting people from all over the world come together and talk about what it's like going through the pandemic, sharing their feelings or anxieties, sharing strategies that can enhance our effectiveness in making sure that the post-pandemic world is safe and healthy and resilient and in alignment with natural systems. And it's been an extraordinary, I can't tell you, Gary, listening day in and day out to the creative genius that's out there of people that are working their hearts out 24/7, 365 for a better world. I mean, it's a dire situation, but one is filled with all kinds of optimism when you see everything that's going on. And then in April, which is the other example, Amsterdam, one of the great cities of the world, made a decision and they announced that they were going to use the crisis of the pandemic to completely reshape the future of Amsterdam. And they've embraced donut economics. And donut economics, for those of you who don't know it, has been developed by a woman named Kate Raworth out of Oxford University. She also holds a post in Cambridge University, brilliant woman, wrote a book called Donut Economics. Just imagine a donut. And the inner circle is what she calls human well-being. Not profit, not gross domestic product, not trade, but the purpose for which Amsterdam will now focus its policy formation and its tax structure is human well-being. And then the outer circle of the donut is the ecology, ecological systems, ecological constraints. So the point of the exercise is how do you develop human well-being within the context of ecological systems and constraints? And within weeks, 400 cities and communities from around the world were in touch with Amsterdam and Kate Raworth saying, we want to do it too. But 3 weeks ago, Copenhagen, another major city, has embraced donut economics. They haven't made a final decision, but it's moving through the city council decision-making process in a very deliberate and positive way. And so we're supporting that. We're bringing it into the awareness of as many people as we can. We have a whole program that is dedicated to donut and regenerative economics. And then I would just conclude, Gary, by saying a third example, which is just everyone needs to take in. If you look at the countries that are doing the worst, including the United States, Brazil, Russia, India, China, they're all ruled by authoritarian men. And the seven countries that are doing the best, New Zealand, Iceland, Germany, other countries, are all run by women.
Jim, let me address that, please. Those are not authoritarian women. The only women right now and for the past that we've allowed positions of power over the national dialogue have been people like Hillary Clinton or Jean Kirkpatrick or Madeleine Albright. These are hyper-alpha females. They do not use their femininity or the spiritual qualities they have. Those are virtually void. I mean, just look at Hillary Clinton and sponsoring the overtaking of the democratically elected government in Honduras, and that was hers. Excuse me. When you look at the world, we can't look at whether it's a man or woman. We have to look at what is the quality of their leadership up to that point. Have they served all interests or corporate interests? And that's why every single corporation in America wanted Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama and Joe Biden. Every single corporation, Wall Street, and he just acknowledged yesterday that he's not going to make Wall Street change on any level. But now I want to go to what I consider a
Gary,
far
let me
more...
Let me just stop you there. That may be true in the United States, but if you take the leader in New Zealand or Iceland or Finland or Denmark... these aren't just, you know, alpha females. These are women that are politically skillful, to be sure. They wouldn't have come to the apex of their particular countries, but they're women of deep humanity.
I agree. Jim, that was the example I was making. That's exactly what I said. That in other countries, you have people who are voted into office and serve well, but they are not there to compete against others as much as they are to show how you can forge unity of multiple parties. We don't have that. We have a duopoly in the United States.
Yeah.
And so that's what I was saying. But here's a more important issue that we must face immediately, and that is, as an investigative journalist also for over 53 years, breaking over 300 original stories, on every single issue that I broke, whether it was on the politics of cancer or the politics of AIDS and challenging them, the media was always on the side of those responsible for the crisis or those assuming they had the crisis in hand. Example, and why this is so important. Right now, I believe that everything we've been taught about the coronavirus is either incorrect or out and out lies, and not because these are stupid people. You're talking about some of the brightest scientists in the world, but then they have a protocol, and the protocol is corporatization and government control over what we should do, and that is vaccinate with unproven vaccines coming at us. There's over 217 different vaccines that are being in development now, and then trusting Anthony Fauci, the same person who misguided everything when it came to the war on AIDS, including AZT, which was fast-tracked, which killed a lot of people, but also then don't prevent a disease. In fact, they've tried to outlaw even discussing or having any article written on disease prevention. Instead, you prevent it by vaccination, that's Bill Gates. And then if, in addition to preventing it, if you should be sick, take one of these very expensive new drugs, whereas we already have existing drugs that are non-toxic and can be used easily and have 100% cure rate from the doctors using them. And this is more and more. Also, for the first time, you have hundreds of scientists and doctors coming forward saying they did this wrong, they did this wrong. And the latest is Dr. Beda, B-E-D-A, M. Stadler, S-T-A-D-L-E-R. Now, she's one of the world's most respected immunologists. And just today, she said the following: the immune response to the virus is stronger than anyone thought. Hence, everything we've done to quarantine healthy people was wrong. It actually hurts their immune system. And then she goes into great depth about why building up the immune system with a healthy diet, stress management, exercise, proper supplementation, that's how historically we have fought off all these other viruses. And it's only the weaker people who have comorbidities because they've had poor diets, like diabetes, being obese, having cancer, emphysema, smoking. These are the people who are most vulnerable. Therefore, our protocols should be coming from immunologists, not virologists. And she makes it very clear that Anthony Fauci and all the others, who she sat on panels with, by the way, they've allowed the government to control the dialogue. As a result, virologists, epidemiologists have led on everything, and immunologists, those who could help us and help us start to protect ourselves, have been locked out. That's also true when anyone who has found that we have done it wrong, like putting COVID patients in nursing homes, and then all the nursing home patients die, and over 55% of all the deaths in New York State were due to nursing home patients who are already there to die. That's why they're in a nursing home with comorbidities. But we didn't tell people this. They just added to the statistics. So on the one hand, the media is fully aware of this, but will never challenge the official position, meaning the corporate official position, not who's president of the United States. And so when you look at any of the issues we're facing today, they want a government-mandated bailout of the economy. And hence, who got bailed out? The rich and powerful corporations. And when they made bad decisions, we washed those clean. And as a result, in effect, we did legal money laundering. We'll take away all your bad debt, just like we did in 2008. We'll take away all your bad debt, all your bad decisions, give you new money free. So now the people are beginning to believe only what the New York Times, CNN, and these people have a history of being wrong on everything. They were also wrong on weapons of mass destruction, but they didn't apologize. They were wrong about the Vietnam War and the domino effect. They're wrong on all these things, yet we continue to believe the media and its allegiance that is never stated to special deep state lobbying and corporate interest. Why can't we understand that we should start to do our own research, or at least have access to alternative research and information and speakers like yourself, for example, Dean Ornish on how not to have heart disease. Now, he's a board-certified physician. Nobody has him on. Nobody has Chris Hedges on. Nobody has Abby Martin on. So the people who have solutions that empower the individuals and groups, they're never given a forum. To the contrary, they're attacked and shamed, and everything they've written is completely off the internet. They're banned. And yet anything, no matter how ridiculous, that comes from the media is immediately ascribed to be the only truth. Your thoughts, please.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more, Gary. I think, you know, there's something very sinister about what is taking place. And in addition to the points that you're making, I would make the point made by Yuval Harari. You know, he's the author of Sapiens and Homo Deus, a brilliant commentator on the human species, an op-ed that he wrote in the Financial Times, where he said, the real threat in this pandemic is not to health, it's to democracy. And I think it's just worth pointing out that the governments use the pandemic to do two things. Number one, shut the world down, put essentially everyone under house arrest, house confinement. And in some countries like Italy and in France, it was quite coercive. Other countries, it was a lot less coercive, like in the Netherlands, where I've been staying, and so forth. But we saw the world governments act in unison to sequester billions of people at the same time. And the point that Harari makes is that the authoritarian governments, of which I think we need to include the United States, are using the pandemic for the instrumentality of increased coercion. We're seeing that on the streets of America with what's happening just most recently in Portland, where you have federal agents that are just disappearing people and acting like the Gestapo. And Trump is going to be deploying more federal troops to more cities controlled by Democrats, as it turns out, as part of a bizarre vendetta that he has. But underneath that is the deployment in countries around the world of SWAT team level militarized police forces. And then the other aspect, which is worth noting, is surveillance in airports now, in countries like China. Governments are using the pandemic to begin a process which is only in its nascent stages, but will only increase as the level of the crisis increases, of monitoring the sort of the biorhythms and health functions of millions of people. And so not only is the notion of privacy, you know, on the internet and on our smartphones and on our computers disappearing, but there's going to be increased intrusion by government into the biorhythms of our own body and one bodies, and then one then just takes it the next step with the almost like a pharmaceutical military complex around vaccines. Big Pharma wants to vaccinate everybody, and I can see a day when the next pandemic, everybody's ordered to be vaccinated. And if you don't do it willingly, you get it anyway. And they're doing it to babies now. It's an extraordinary thing. So that the economics of Big Pharma, as you were pointing out, are all over the pandemic, and the obsession in the media around the vaccine that's going to cure everything. Well, the fact is there's no vaccine for the COVID virus that's going to solve anything, because those viruses evolve. And at the same time, what we should be doing, eating healthy diets, getting out in nature, playing in the dirt, you know, living authentic lives with livelihoods that are meaningful to us and community and with joy, that's what keeps you healthy. It's not a vaccine. And so there are some very troubling tendencies around this pandemic that, if not scrutinized clearly, will end up with a deeper overlay of the national security state intruding on us all.
Signs of our collective spiritual poverty. For example, there's absolutely no reason why Trump should still be in office. Aside from his aberrant psychological disorders, he has a rap sheet miles long and extending throughout his business career. However, we have two parties that are equally incompetent, equally beholden to private interests rather than the public. And this raises for many people a moral dilemma. Do I vote for the lesser of two evils, or for an independent or third or fourth or fifth party candidate that truly represents higher human and social values, even if it in this moment it will seem like a wasted vote? But is it a wasted vote if enough of us as I've done, voting for Ralph Nader repeatedly and Jill Stein and Rocky Anderson, is it a wasted vote when the honest issues, the honest solutions, the all-inclusive way of approaching a problem are laid out so the public at least can hear these ideas instead of just the two-party system? Both of those parties are completely under the control of special interest group and lobbyists, and that's not a conspiracy theory. That's real. And so, as far as I know, and I voted for the Green Party since its inception, I know where I stand. But for many others, particularly the younger generation who supported Bernie's socialist agenda but are very reluctant to put their support behind a centrist, rank-and-file Democrat, careerist like Biden, who has a horrible track record on almost all domestic and foreign issues and has made out-and-out racist statements repeatedly and supported not allowing busing, etc., it's not better to vote one's, is it not better to vote one's inner conscious rather than casting a vote for someone who simply appears less destructive? I mean, as you know from your studies of religion, the Catholic Church during the Inquisitional period was actually extremely lenient from its perspective. If you confessed a heresy, for example, if you're a woman and you had your period and you didn't die, and therefore the priest and or the jurist said that you were having sex with the devil, if you agreed, yes, I did, I had sex with the devil, okay, we will forgive you. We're only going to crucify you to death, but we're not going to crucify you, then hang you. And so to me, that's true. That actually happened. So what good is it for one person to do things that are absolutely against all common sense and reason, where we have no peace advocates that are sent peace ambassadors to heal the wounds that we have created around the world, where we have no bringing back the military-industrial complex and putting that money into social systems that will help regenerate ghettos? Neither party is going to do that. So then I ask, because Americans have been doing this for far too long, is it also our voting habits that have created the white swan we're in today? Essentially, this is an example of cognitive dissonance that defines our society as a whole. Your thoughts, please.
Well, I think you're making again another very profound point through your question. You know, how does one think about civic virtue in a failed state? How does one conceive of democracy in a world of hyper technology, hyper complexity, and huge corporate dominance and control? You know, if you go back 1,000 years, the church dominated politics. And then after the Renaissance and the Enlightenment, you know, politicians dominated politics. And now the corporations dominate politics. You know, and so what does democracy mean in that context? And, you know, I personally, Gary, I've been living in Europe. I just decided that the toxicity in the United States is just at such a level, it's not good for my health. And so I've been spending more and more time for me in the Netherlands. You know, the Dutch, for example, sailed right through the pandemic. There was no coercion. Everybody did what was commonsensically appropriate. They have an incredibly sophisticated healthcare system. They do not have a large disparity between the rich and the poor. It's not a perfect country. It's in Europe, obviously, and there's within the whole the zone of the EU, et cetera. But there's a civility and a humanity here that has disappeared in the United States. I think for me too, it's not so much voting as taking seriously, I guess, Buckminster Fuller, that don't engage with the systems that are dying and are obsolete, build anew. So that's what we're doing with Ubiquity University. How do we build a new educational system that's focused on giving the young people the mindsets and skill sets and tool sets to navigate hyper complexity and come together to solve global problems? How do we support what Amsterdam's doing and what Copenhagen is doing? How do we commit ourselves in our lives to working each and every day on that cause that is a source of our passion? That to me is at the heart of civic engagement. And that's why I so admire what you've done and with the Progressive Radio Network and all your groundbreaking, you know, documentaries and journalism. You know, you've pursued the truth as clearly as you saw it, and then just put it out there. That to me is real democracy. And I think we have to vote. And like you, I tend to vote for the people of conscience. I don't know who's going to be on the ballot in November, but I don't think I can vote for Joe Biden, because I know in advance, you know, it's like a friend of mine said, you know, Trump can't tell the truth and Biden can't remember it. You know, what are we doing that we're subjecting our democratic electoral process to two choices like that? We should be ashamed of ourselves, given, you know, what America potentially could be. So I think we support the Green parties and we do everything we can in the spirit of Buckminster Fuller to build the new world. And let the old world collapse of its own weight, because it is just totally out of control. That's not the whole answer, but it's some other perspectives.
Our final question today, and you'll have about 3 minutes, if you would please, to answer this, since you've been in Europe, for this entire year or so, I'm uncertain how much you have been following the different sides of the educational issues that we're facing. And we are facing a really dumbed down educational system. In fact, they've just said now that math is racist. Therefore, they're not going to teach math in colleges. And they don't want to have any entrance exams or any criteria whatsoever. And that they don't want to take any tests when they're in school. And they want a classroom that doesn't make them feel in any way uncomfortable. And I'm thinking, my goodness, the real world is not going to cater to your, you know, insecurities and uncertainties and your lack of scholarship and your lack of critical thinking skills and even the idea that you should have those critical thinking skills, because now that's considered a microaggression. If you want someone to think deeper than what they have, you're aggressing them and therefore making them feel threatened for their life, and therefore a whole system of bureaucracy has been put into place that comforts that person without ever questioning them and what they brought and how they were evolved to have these insecurities, and therefore a shame culture. I do not see a happy ending if what we're going to do over the next, let's say, 10 years is just to graduate from all institutions, with the exception of those who choose to bear down and learn the lessons. And I just see a whole generation of functional illiterates. Your thoughts?
Well, I think you're right. The educational system is breaking down. Students are not being prepared. And what we need is a system that emphasizes knowledge, but it needs to be new knowledge. Not teaching neoliberal capitalist economics, but teaching donut economics, teaching generative economics. We also need an educational system that is preparing young people at the level of their personal growth. They need to learn soft skills. They need to learn mindfulness. They need to learn about nutrition. They need to learn life skills. They need to be able to navigate a world that is spinning at faster and faster I read just the other day that knowledge, human knowledge, is doubling every 12 and a half minutes. I mean, that, what does education do with that? And then thirdly, I think education needs to prepare young people to be socially active. They need to be trained to be social activists. And that's what Ubiquity does. You know, we have knowledge, it's new thinking. We have what we call self-mastery and what we call social impact. And if you bring together new knowledge with personal growth and development, with an awareness that our generation has got to solve the central challenges, you just unleash human potential in a way that the current educational system is not doing. So that's one reason why I'm in education. I think that the ultimate revolution is how you shape the minds and the hearts and the hands of the next generation. And we need to do it in a completely new way.
Well said, Jim. Jim, thank you very much for being with us today. Jim Garrison, his websites are ubiquityuniversity.org and wisdomuniversity.org. All the best to you, Jim.
You too, Gary. Be well.
I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening and have a nice day.
Mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, there's far too many.